Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I'm on a plane in just a few days, heading out to California for 5 tour stops in 5 different cities, and you are invited. Tuesday, Sacramento. Wednesday, San Jose. Friday in San Luis Obispo. Saturday in Riverside, California. We'll wrap up Sunday in San Diego. All those details at thethinkingatheist.com/events. And yes, there will be a show next Tuesday. It's going to air while I'm traveling, but it's going to be teed up and ready for you. It's an interesting broadcast about interfaith relationships. People who disagree on the subject of God and spirituality and yet choose to bond their lives together. How does that work? We're going to have a show on that next week and some other interesting stuff teed up for September. We're going to do a show on Buddhism and atheists who are also Buddhists. We're going to do a show about pseudoscience in relation to food and nutrition. The show is called Woo-trition. We're going to do that in September. Lots of good stuff on the horizon in the weeks to come. And if you have a perspective you want to share or an opinion or whatever, you can email podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Today's show is kind of an unusual format. It's a variety show, really. We're going to talk about a great many things, a potpourri of subjects. We have the burkini ban in France. We're going to talk about that and talk with Sarah Hayter, a former Muslim who is now part of Ex-Muslims of North America. We're going to talk to Chris Matheson. He is the screenwriter and humorist who wrote the book The Story of God. We highlighted that project last year. Well, he's got some extra pages written from Satan's perspective, which I will read a few of those pages for you on the air. And he wants to give some copies of the audiobook away to some members of our audience. So that's coming up later in the show. My first subject, the thing I want to talk about right off the bat, is in relation to an NPR article that just released, where NPR has declared that they're going to nix the comment sections of their website, meaning that when they post a news story, instead of having the comments thread below, they've decided it's not all that useful and they've decided to pull the plug on comments. Well, you've heard me from time to time talk about my own frustrations with comment sections. Now, hang on. I'm not going to ever nix the comment sections on my pages. All right, just stop. When I posted this story, we were talking about it, and I posted my own support of NPR. Like, I think, fine, good for them. People flipped out and said, this is an echo chamber. This is an attempt to quell a dissenting voice, as if comment sections are the only places that dissent can be voiced, right? And then they took the next step that, oh, if Seth ever pulls the comment, I'm not pulling the comment sections. You go to YouTube, you go to social, everywhere you go, my comment sections are all wide open. They're there. They're going to be there. Stop. Just take a pill already. And this is one of the challenges I have with comment sections, is that people protest and froth at the mouth about what they think you said or what they expected you to say or what they fear you'll say or whatever suits their agenda, not what you actually said. I didn't say I was going to nix my comment section, but I'm interested in NPR's very public decision to pull the plug. What's that about? We're going to talk about that here in just a second. First, I do want to say a huge thank you out to today's show sponsor, Phil Ferguson, host of The Phil Ferguson Show. Phil, great to have you. How's it going?
I am fantastic. How you doing?
I'm well. You know, it's interesting. We did this show together a few months back, Atheism and Finance, and I was thinking it's kind of a sterile topic. How many people are really going to go for this? And it turned out to be, I think, one of the most popular shows I've had this year, which is kind of what the Phil Ferguson Show is. You deal with finance, but you also go well beyond. You want to flesh that out real fast?
Yeah, it's always one of those things when I told people I wanted a show that was part finance and part atheism, they said, you can't do that. And I tell people I do whatever the fuck I want. We've talked about gold, tactical investing. We've talked about Donald Trump's fiscal policies. We've talked about how past performance does not help you predict which mutual funds to buy. We've talked about ripoffs and scams, but I've also had on a student from the Secular Student Alliance explaining why they're a great organization. We raised $1,300 for them. Had on Dan Errol from Danthropology blog, and him and I talked about the brand new boat that won't float in Kentucky. We had a great time with that.
Nate's been doing a lot of work on the Ark Encounter. You had Magnum Bosco on a while back to talk about street epistemology. And I'm curious about the Motley Fool thing. You were talking on one of your more recent shows about how the Motley Fool, which is a finance-related show that I listened to back in the day, some of their math doesn't add up. Real fast, can you kind of give me a little bit more on that?
Yeah, it's a fantastic show. They're definitely showmen, but the very thing that launched the Motley Fools was called the Foolish Four. They created a mathematical model that follows a philosophy called tactical investing, and it made them famous, but it didn't work. You actually lost money or didn't make as much money, but it still was neat enough that it made them famous, even though it didn't actually work, which is hysterical.
I'm insanely curious. I've got to go back and check that out. Anyway, the Phil Ferguson Show, I will make sure and include the link of your broadcast in the description box of this show and send everybody your direction. Just a lot of good stuff out there. Thanks for your great work. And I'm going to read this article from NPR, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to kind of pick your brain here for just a second. So hang with me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Okay, let me just read this article. It's dated August the 17th, written by Elizabeth Jensen. And it says, NPR website to get rid of comments. Now, this is posted on NPR itself under its media and society section. And the article says this. NPR is making an announcement today that's sure to upset a loyal core of its audience. Those who comment online at NPR.org, including those who comment on this blog, as of August 23rd, online comments, a feature of the site since 2008, will be disabled. With the change, NPR joins a long list of other news organizations choosing to move conversations about its journalism off its own site and instead rely on social media to pick up the slack. But NPR stands for National Public Radio, so a decision to limit public input at NPR.org seems especially jarring. The decision should not be taken to mean that NPR does not value audience engagement, said Scott Montgomery, managing editor for Digital News. Quote, we've been working on audience engagement, user connections, and a variety of ways for many, many years, certainly going back to even before the internet. It is part of public media. It's important to us, he told me. But at this point, he argued, the audience itself has decided for NPR, choosing to engage much more via social media, primarily on Twitter and Facebook, rather than in the NPR.org comments section. Quote, we've reached the point where we've realized that there are other better ways to achieve the same kind of community discussion around the issues we raise in our journalism, he said, with money and spending it efficiently part of the issue. More than 5 million people each month engage with NPR on Twitter, compared to just a fraction of that number in the NPR.org comments. In relative terms, as we set priorities, he says, it becomes increasingly clear that the market has spoken. This is where people want to engage with us, so that's what we're going to emphasize. I did find the numbers quite startling. This is the reporter. In July, NPR.org recorded nearly 33 million unique users and 491,000 comments. But those comments came from just 19,400 commenters. All right, so 33 million unique users, but 19,400 commenters. That's 0.06% of users who are commenting, a number that has stayed steady through 2016. When NPR analyzed the number of people who left at least one comment in both June and July, the numbers showed an even more interesting pattern. Just 4,300 users posted about 145 comments apiece, or 67% of all NPR.org comments for the last 2 months. More than half of all comments in May, June, and July combined came from a mere 2,600 users. Again, that's 2,600 out of 33 million page users. The conclusion, NPR's commenting system, which gets more expensive the more comments that are posted, and in some months has cost NPR twice what was budgeted, is serving a very, very small slice of its overall audience. It's not possible to tell who these commenters are. Some users comment anonymously, but there are some clues that indicate those who comment are not wholly representative of the overall NPR audience. They overwhelmingly comment via the desktop. Younger users tend to find NPR.org via mobile. And a Google estimate suggested that the commenters were 83% male, while overall NPR.org users were just 52% male, Montgomery said. When viewed purely from the perspective of whether the comments were fostering constructive conversations, the change should come as no surprise. The number of complaints to NPR about the current comment system has been growing. Complaints that comments were censored by the outside moderators, and that commenters were behaving inappropriately and harassing other commenters. Mike Durio of Phoenix seemed to sum it up in an email to my office back in April. Quote, "Have you considered doing away with the comment sections or tighter moderation?" he wrote. "The comments have developed into the Punch and Judy fest of moronic, unilluminating observations and petty insults I've seen on other pretty much every other internet site that allows comments. This is not in keeping with NPR's take a step back, take a deep breath reporting." And noted, now thread hijacking and personal insults are becoming the stock in trade. Frequent posters use the forums to duke it out with one another. A user named Mary from Raleigh, North Carolina, wrote to implore, "Remove the comment section from your articles. The rude, hateful, racist, judgmental comments far outweigh those who may want to engage in some intelligent sideline conversation about the actual subject of the article. I'm appalled at the amount of free hate that is found on a website that represents honest and unbiased reporting, such as NPR. What are you really gaining from all these rabid comments other than proof that a sad slice of humanity that preys on the weak while spreading their hate?" Other organizations, such as the New York Times, manage to keep their comments relatively civil, but they use heavy in-house human moderation that costs far more than NPR currently spends on its outsourced system, according to NPR executives who are familiar with the numbers. The Times also opens only 10% of its articles for comments, but is working to increase that percentage, and keeps the comment threads open for just 1 week. NPR currently allows comments on all articles for 2 weeks. And this article on NPR continues, and so will I. There are disadvantages to using social media as a commenting platform. Fitting a comment into 140 Twitter characters is cumbersome and time-consuming. Only about 20 NPR stories are posted to Facebook each day, out of the total of 45 to 50 stories that get posted to NPR.org. Not everyone wants to create a Facebook or Twitter account. And Montgomery acknowledged, with some of the social media platforms, you miss the opportunity to have users engage with one another on the same story. But the Facebook discussions that do take place in particular tend to be more civil. And most likely because users are required to use their own names. Not that fake accounts don't get through, but there seem to be far fewer than the predominantly fake names that NPR commenters currently rely on. One more section of the article is titled, "What is NPR's Obligation?" And I'll read just a portion of this and then discuss here. "An argument I know NPR will hear, because I've received some letters about it during my tenure, is that NPR, which indirectly receives federal funding via the membership fees paid by stations, has an obligation to provide such a forum for listeners. It does not, in fact, have any such legal obligation. NPR's obligation is to, quote, provide information, not to create and maintain a public square. But if NPR has no obligation to provide such a space, the dictates of today's journalism, where audiences expect to be able to interact with their news providers, would suggest NPR should make an effort to create one. It seems to me that it has at least made a good faith attempt." And the article goes on to talk about the fact that NPR is actually exploring and experimenting with other options for audience interaction, and we should see those options or experiments in the next 6 to 9 months. So anyway, NPR has decided they're going to pull the plug on the comment sections of their news story, and people are going apeshit. I think for me as a host and as an admin, as someone who is part of a pretty large, relatively large online community, I think my biggest challenge with comment sections often comes from YouTube. And of course, this is when people who can only speak in extremes start to speak in extremes. It's hugely frustrating. When you say there's not a lot that's being said on YouTube that is useful or constructive, it's like when you post a video and there's always the person who just types first or second. I mean, YouTube's filled with this kind of thing. Or they'll simply post something trollish or offensive because they enjoy being trollish and offensive. And I think I agree with the article from NPR that in my experience, the comment sections on Facebook for me have been more useful. Now, again, I'm sure there are tons of people who are jumping to the extreme conclusion that no one can ever get benefit from a YouTube comment section. Did I say that? No, I did not say that. In fact, I will usually monitor YouTube comments when a video or podcast posts because it's in that first critical day or so that I will discover if there's a flaw or a problem. Is there a glitch? Is there bad information? Is there something that needs to be addressed and fixed? And those of you who know me know that I will then go back and I'll try to make the revision or post an annotation making the correction. I mean, obviously, if there's something wrong, I want to know about it. But when we scan the hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of comments in the comments section, I am astounded and amazed, especially on YouTube, in my own experience, especially on YouTube, how often they're either ranting about a soapbox that they dragged into the room that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, or they're addressing what we're talking about in just an unproductive or even vitriolic way and being really nasty to other people. Have you noticed that in so many ways we have lost the ability to have disagreement and still be friendly? David Smalley just wrote a blog and posted a podcast called What's Killing the Atheist Movement. And I won't be presumptuous enough to read his content here, but it's interesting that this story from NPR came out a couple of weeks ago. So I started talking about comment sections, and he's experiencing some of the same frustrations. He's seeing people who were just chewing each other to ribbons, and we're all kind of tired of it. And so the question then becomes, how productive is this? How much benefit does it bring you? If I go to Ken Ham's YouTube page, or whoever, I don't know if he's disabled comments or not, there are many people in the faith, especially, who will disable comments as a way to insulate themselves from criticism. I think we can see that coming. And that's one reason that I would never personally nix or delete or discontinue the comment sections on my own pages. It's because I'd rather see that conduit remain open, even if it allows in the lowest common denominator, the malcontents and trolls and those who like to stir the shitstorm and be ugly to other people. I mean, you're going to get the worst with the best, right? I leave those doors open. I don't do hardly any banning. It happens from time to time. And if someone comes in and they are being abusive or disruptive in some way, there are occasions on any of the pages that I host where I will escort them from the room. If you come in and you start being verbally abusive to people or disruptive, or you're suffocating the wall with just white noise and you're beginning to diminish the experience for other people, don't be surprised if you lose your visitation privileges. And I realize that's a bit subjective. You know, it depends on the temperature of the site that you're trying to host and the environment that you're trying to foster for the people that are there. And I always try to err on the side of caution to make sure that no one is unjustly removed. You know, there are people come in and they'll all cap and they'll shout and they'll carry on and they stay. You have to be pretty extreme to get shown the door on the thinking atheist. But when it happens, an interesting phenomenon takes place, and that is this weird free speech martyrdom that they claim for themselves. I mean, they'll scream and wail and protest that we're just cultish, that this is an echo chamber attempting to isolate itself from the radical who stands on the outside, who is objectively looking in and keeping the rest of us honest. This is a trampling of someone's constitutional right to free expression, blah, 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 blah. Of course, the rest of us just look at them like they're out of their mind. I don't know where they got told or stole the idea that they can show up anywhere, disrupt and abuse, and the rest of us have to stand around and listen to it. Well, you just want to surround yourself with people who agree with you. You got to be shitting me. Anybody who would say such an asinine thing is just not paying attention, or they're lying outright. Have you seen the thinking atheist community? It's loaded with people with differing perspectives, challenging each other and disagreeing with each other all the time. It happens all the time, and it is largely healthy. I'm not talking about disagreement. I'm not talking about honest criticism. I'm not talking about respectful dissension. I'm talking about those people who walk in and piss on everyone and everything and are apparently suffering from the delusion that they are too important to be ignored. Now, I love this community. I love what I do. I love the Thinking Atheist family, for lack of a better word, because I think in many ways we sort of have come together to support each other and to challenge each other. We enjoy a sense of connection here in this sort of corner of the movement. And it's a real privilege to be able to do what I do and to be able to be a part of this. But don't sell yourself on the idea that if you come in and vomit vitriol, and you are banned from the Thinking Atheist YouTube page, don't kid yourself. The other 200,000 plus subscribers will probably get on with the rest of their day just fine without you. Hell, I understand the value of comment section. Somebody on Facebook pointed out the irony of me asking people about the merits of comment sections in a comment section. I get that. I use comment sections mostly on social media to help take the temperature of the audience or to ask their opinions about specific things or to see, would you like to do a show about this or this event happened? What do you think? I have a question. What do you think the answer to this is? I use social media and comment sections in this way. But not all comment sections are created equal. And there are some places out there on the internet, I don't know if it's the nature of the content or the host or the audience or what, the comment sections are just a sewer. They're just a septic tank of putrescence. They are almost useless. It's frustrating. It's the dark side of the comment section. Anyway, that's what I wanted to start the show with. I'm sure our listeners will have an opinion, and I'm sure they will post those opinions in the comment section. I've kept Phil Ferguson standing by long enough. I knew that Phil, being an activist and a host and a content producer, would have an opinion because he has comment sections of his own and might want to weigh in. So, Phil Ferguson, what's your take on all this?
I find comment sections to be suboptimal. We'll just go with that. Humans have issues with communication, and I fall into that category, and I'm much better verbally, and even there I have issues, but in writing, in text, in short snippets, it's horrible, absolutely horrible. The number of times I'll type something and someone will overgeneralize or take to an extreme something that I said, or they'll attack me for something I didn't even say. I mean, I make enough of my own mistakes. Don't create them for me. And they'll attack a position that I'm not taking. I guess that's the classic straw man. And they go on a big rant, and I end up trying to defend myself. And even on my Facebook wall, it's so, so very difficult for people to stay on the topic of the post. And we all have our own baggage. There's things we're thinking about. There's places we've been wronged in our lives. And we see something that's tangentially related, and we just unload on the poor victim's Facebook wall. And it can get a little out of hand sometimes.
And this is the where the person says, oh, fine. You just want to insulate yourself from criticism, Phil. You just don't want to hear the radicals out here on the fringe who have a clearer vision of what you're about and what you're doing wrong, keeping you honest, calling you to task. I mean, this is, they sort of anointed themselves in some cases, certainly not all, but in some cases, kind of a righteous overseer to help police the comments threads and the content of every page. I don't know if that's an assigning of importance to oneself greater than you actually have, or if there's some merit to it. Maybe it does help to have all these people out there prepared.
Well, I do like the discussion. I like the dialogue. And matter of fact, I'm actually surprisingly open to people correcting me, especially if they point out information. I do make mistakes.
Oh, and this community will find the mistake in the first 90 seconds. Yeah. That is beneficial and useful.
And I welcome that. I don't know that I always like it, at least not when it happens, because I'm a human and I respond poorly. But I try to get past that and check the links and the sources that they send. And if they're right, I'm going to have to say that they're right. So if I exclude myself, if I put myself in a bubble, I'm never going to learn anything new because I'm only going to find people that agree with me. I stop growing. But what I do not like is personal attacks. And when someone gets on my wall and starts calling me names, or, you know, they call me a fascist, or a Shillery supporter, or a Drumpf supporter, as soon as they start using these terrible names for anybody, I lose interest. And I actually tell them, stick to the topic. We can talk about it. We can disagree about it. But if you're going to attack me, it's not going to happen. And on my Facebook wall, that's where I normally deal with comments, I consider that to be part of my living room. And if you're over at my house for dinner and we have a great discussion and we disagree, I'm all for it. But if you start calling me names and you start calling me an asshole and a fucktard and whatever in my living room, I'm kicking your ass out. And there's a definitely strong possibility you're never coming back. And I treat my wall, my Facebook wall, as part of my house. It's my living room. I'm welcoming you in. Talk to me. Disagree. Educate me. But don't attack me. I want to make a very clear distinction between people and ideas. And I have this problem often when talking with Christians. If I make a comment that the idea of handling snakes is a silly idea, poisonous snakes is a silly idea, they feel attacked personally. And I have to explain that I'm attacking the idea, not calling them stupid. But then I also have people in the movement that are saying they reserve the right to shame people that they disagree with, to call them bad names and say that they're a bad person. But yet at the same time, they will say that no one should shame them and no one should call them a bad person. I agree with the second part of what they said, but I don't agree with the first part. If you don't want to be called names, if you don't want to be shamed, you should not engage in those behaviors. If you don't want to talk to somebody, fine. If you don't want to be friends with them on Facebook, fine. But leave me the fuck out of it. If you've got an issue with somebody, handle it like an adult. I got set off because someone included me in a post on their wall. Like, this person has bad ideas, and I see the famous skeptic Phil Ferguson is friends with them. What the fuck do I have to do with it? Leave me out of it.
So you're friends with someone that they disagree with and are held in contempt. Therefore, you're guilty by association.
That's right. And I said, don't call me out. And they go, I didn't call you out. And I go, you did. That was the point of you putting my name in there, was to call me out and to shame me and to point out to me that I'm mutual friends with you, with somebody that you disagree with. Whoop-de-doody-doo.
Don't you find all this exhausting? I mean, it's exhausting with so many other things that you and I ought to be thinking about and doing and producing. And instead, how much time and energy and focus does it take when you stop? You hit the brakes and you have to stop and you have to address some inflammatory element in a single comment sections out of hundreds of millions of comment sections. It's exhausting to me.
Well, one of the things that I had a couple times in this simple post that I put up about leaving me out of your friend battles, someone put a comment. They said, so basically, Phil, what you believe is X. I'm like, don't tell me what I believe. If you want to have a conversation, ask me what I believe.
I don't think they're interested in what you believe. I really don't. I think a lot of those people, it fits a narrative that they're selling better if they... It's like that saying, it's not what you're called, it's what you answer to. I mean, they can call you this, and that's an easier fit to fit their narrative. They're not as interested in what you would answer to, what really is your position, your mindset, your perspective, your attitudes, what you have to say and why you say it isn't as important. It's almost a caricature of what you have to say and why you say it. It's easier to paint the caricature of you and then throw tomatoes at it.
Well, it's like one of those comments I'll see from time to time. Well, atheists basically believe.
I'm sorry. Atheists.
Whoever follows is probably wrong. I mean, there's some generalities and there's things in common. And you might have some merit to that point if you say people that belong to American Humanists Association believe, because at least they have a published list of stuff that they believe. And even then, you don't have to agree to all of it. Not everybody who's a Catholic literally thinks that when you eat the wafer, it becomes the body of Jesus Christ, which always leads me to the question, if you go to communion often enough, do you get all the parts?
That's a whole other show. That's a little bit of a digression, but now you got me thinking about it. I mean, does it eventually add up to an entire Jesus? I don't really know. now I've totally lost my train of thought. Thanks, Phil.
Yep, I'm here to help, buddy.
Well, ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't ever want to have a community, and I won't have a community that ever snuffs out discourse. I mean, comment sections are what they are, for good and for ill. But I think it's a discussion that's interesting and worth having. You know, what's the merit of having a comment section? Who often uses it? What percentage of a larger audience takes time to comment? Do comment sections attract a certain ilk of people? You know, do you find those who are malcontented, who have a shit ton of time on their hands, who camp out, who like to comment to the tune of dozens upon dozens of posts? Does the comment section serve them and not serve the larger community? I think these are all valid questions that should be asked and should be answered. And so that's why I figured I'd ask you, another YouTube activist, another host, another podcaster, another person who's got their sort of mitts into the movement, what they thought. So I wish you the best out there on your show and in your comment sections. And I'm sure our paths will cross again pretty soon. Okay, Phil?
Thanks for having me on. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care. After a short break here, I'm going to come back and share with you a story that was posted by Hemet Mehta on The Friendly Atheist that I couldn't believe was real. I thought it was maybe a Babylon Bee story or The Onion or something, but I guess it's legit. It's about the brother of a Mormon polygamist who was supposed to make a court appearance on charges of fraud and has disappeared. And his attorney just posted an excuse as to where he went and why he wasn't in court. And the excuse is crazy. We're going to talk about France's now suspended burkini ban. The burkini is a surreal sight, is it not? Google it if you haven't seen it. And France had said, we are now making this illegal on our beaches, and there's an explosion of controversy. They've now suspended the ban. We're going to get into that story in just a few. And near the end of the show, to cap things, I'm going to talk again to author Chris Matheson. Chris is one of the co-writers of the popular 80s film Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and he wrote a book called The Story of God. Well, we had Chris on the show, read from the book, but he's added to the book. He's got more, in addition, some supplements to the book as it releases in paperback, and he's given me permission to read more of the Book of God to the audience. So we're going to cap the show with that and talk to Chris here for just a few near the ending of the broadcast. We'll kick all that off here in just a second. Hang on. By the way, if you were curious about the story that we did last week about Matt Wilborn of Muskogee, Oklahoma, who wanted to donate $100 to the Murrah Indian Children's Home, and he wanted to make that donation in the name of the atheist group in Muskogee, the Muskogee Atheist Community, and then they refused the money because they are funded by the American Baptist Churches Association, didn't want an atheist group associated with them. That has ended up, I think, in the neighborhood of $30,000, right? Matt started with $100. They said no. He ramped it up to $250. They didn't respond. He called the media, started a GoFundMe campaign. People rallied from all across the planet, both religious and non-religious alike, saying, look, I thought it was about the children, and people donated. $20 here, $50 there, $5 here, whatever. They raised at about $30,000. And there were many questions as to whether or not the Murrah Indian Children's Home was going to actually take the money? Well, according to Matt Pages, about $5,000 will be donated to the children's home. And as I understand it, if the children's home still refuses it from the atheist community, we give it to another organization, a church or whatever, we're going to have them give it. We're going to make sure that the money goes to them, according to Matt. And then after taxes and fees, the rest is going to go to Camp Quest, Oklahoma. Now, I saw some, you know, potentially valid criticisms online that after the original donation was refused and Matt called the press and this thing exploded on social media, it was no longer about the children. It became about the agenda. This is a middle finger. This is about making a point. This is about the soapbox. There may be a measure of that, I think, that has merit. But I don't discount this type of campaign simply because it also provided the opportunity to demonstrate that non-believers in God are still or can be believers in good. I don't really mind that there was an agenda attached to it. The children still benefit, the charities still benefit, and I think we're drawing a larger circle around the fact that we just want to help. We want to be part of the solutions out there, and we shouldn't be excluded from the opportunities to do so because you and I have a disagreement about theological or spiritual matters. We wanted to draw a circle around the pettiness of someone saying, your money's not good here. I think that has value. I think it has merit. Did some of it sort of appear on the surface as a stunt? Yeah, and maybe in some ways it was. But was it a worthy endeavor? And did it raise approximately $30,000 to go to benefit those less fortunate than us? Was good done for goodness' sake, the good being the message that non-believers can positively participate in helping other people and the actual gesture of helping other people? I think that has merit. So anyway, if you were curious as to how the story came out, about 30 grand raised in just a few days, donated by people both religious and atheist from all around the world. The Friendly Atheist posted a story just a few days ago that I had to share with you. You know, we hear a lot of crazy shit coming out of the faith, especially the Mormon Church. Hell, I wrote a whole chapter on Mormonism in my book, Sacred Cows, and we were just scratching the surface. In fact, you want to read a great book on the Mormons, read the book The Mormons by David Fitzgerald. It is crazy. Well, Hemet writes the story that in June, the brother of a polygamist, a Mormon polygamist named Warren Jeffs, the brother's name is Lyle. He was supposed to appear in court. I think he was supposed to appear last week in court, but he disappeared in June. Now, Lyle Jeffs is up on charges of fraud, that he defrauded the U.S. government to the tune of millions of bucks. You know, he had the ankle monitor on and everything, and he was waiting for his court date. Well, apparently he was able to get himself out of the ankle monitor, and he hasn't been seen for months. So there's a court filing by his attorney that offers an explanation as to why this guy disappeared. And I will read it verbatim. Quote, "As this court is well aware, Mr. Jeffs is currently not available to inform his counsel whether or not he agrees to the continuance, whether his absence is based on absconding, as oft alleged by the government in their filings, or whether he was taken and secreted against his will, or whether he experienced the miracle of rapture, is unknown to counsel," Catherine Nestor wrote. "However, his absence prevents counsel from obtaining his approval," blah, 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 blah. Now, it's possible, and even Hemet mentions this in the article, that this is an attempt at levity, that it's, I think Hemet called it, potential gallows humor. Maybe she's just trying to be funny. But she submitted, in a filing produced for the court, a line which says one of the reasons that he might not have appeared to face the charges against him is that he was raptured by Jesus Christ. Another story here in the month of August that people are talking about has to do with this anti-gay pastor who's based in Louisiana where they've had all the flooding. His name is Tony Perkins. He's the president of Family Research Council. And he had said in the past that Hurricane Joaquin was God's punishment. You know, when natural disasters happen, this is normally when we see the prophets of doom coming out and saying, God has either punished us or he's simply removed his hand of protection because we're just so gay, or we're so permissive, or we're so sinful, or whatever. And so this guy, Tony Perkins, had said in the past that all of this legalizing of gay marriage has brought about God's punishment, and that's why Hurricane Joaquin did so much horrible damage, right? When people's homes were destroyed in the floods and in the storms, God was punishing us. Well, he lives in Louisiana, and his home was just destroyed by flood. Remember, this is the same guy that said Uganda's Kill the Gays bill is an effort to, quote, uphold moral conduct. And he says the reason that suicide rates are higher in the LGBT community is because these people have realized that they are abnormal, right? Their perversity against God's model has caused them a kind of self-loathing that leads to suicide. Well, he had to escape his own house by canoe when water had poured into his house. Now, 40,000 homes have been destroyed in the crisis in Louisiana, 11 people killed since the whole region was flooded. I was reading an article in Alternet that said, karma is a bitch, Tony Perkins. Now, I don't believe in karma. I believe in cause and effect, but I don't believe that there's an equilibrium of the universe and all that kind of stuff. But it is ironic to see this guy who had been talking about the punishment of God in the form of natural disasters having to escape his own house in a canoe after it's destroyed by flood. Irony level 1000. How did he rationalize this? He said, the storm was sent, the crisis was sent, the flooding of his home was sent, quote, as an incredible, encouraging spiritual exercise to take you to the next level in your walk with an almighty and gracious God who does all things well. 40,000 homes destroyed while God is busy finding lost car keys and making rainbows and giving you the best parking space. It just makes no sense to some of us anyway. I mentioned earlier in the broadcast we were going to talk about this burkini controversy for just a bit. As reported in BBC News, France's highest administrative court has suspended a ban on full-body burkini swimsuits that was imposed in a town on the Mediterranean coast, saying the ban seriously and clearly illegally breached fundamental freedoms. The ruling can set a precedent for up to 30 other towns that imposed bans on their beaches. Much of this controversy about the burkini ban centering around a photograph of these police officers. There's four armed male French police officers demanding that a woman who was in a headscarf, pants, and sleeves remove layers of her clothing on a beach in Nice. And she was given a ticket. The ticket was for not wearing an outfit respecting good morals and secularism. The burkini is an odd sight to behold. It's a full-body swimsuit for women that is supposed to be in line, quote, in line with Islamic values. And this summer, 15 towns in France banned the burkini. And France has now reversed that ban. They did so on the 26th of August, according to the Associated Press. This burkini ban partially is a response to the attack in Nice, France, when the truck driver, who was supposedly an agent for ISIS or had pledged allegiance to ISIS, drove through a group during a Bastille Day celebration, and he killed 80 people. And so this law was put into place as sort of a protection of the secularity of France. This is a reflection of the country's constitution and a way to sort of stand against what they called the regressive nature of the burqa. The entire conversation explodes into conversations about the encroachment of Islam and Islamic cultures, human rights, and anti-Muslim bigotry. Sarah Hayter is an activist and a writer and an ex-Muslim. Co-founder of Ex-Muslims of North America, she had written a fascinating article, kind of an opinion piece for Heat Street called An Ex-Muslim's View, Repressive Burkini Bans Will Do More Harm Than Good. Well, I wanted Sarah's perspective on the Burkini. And so I asked her to join me on the radio for just a few minutes. Hey, Sarah, how's it going?
Hi, Seth. I'm doing good. How are you?
First of all, what's the difference between the burqa and the hijab?
Well, a burqa is a specific kind of hijab. Hijab technically covers a wide variety of coverings, but this is actually not about any kind of a face veil. The burkini, I mean, that's just what they call it. It's just a catchy little way of speaking about just a loose garment that covers the head and the entire body with the exception of the hands and the face.
So after the attacks in France decides they've had it up to here and they're going to draw a line in the sand. They're going to put their foot down and say, we're going to protect our culture, what they call secular culture, I think in some of the articles that I've read. We're going to ban the burkini outright. And you think, now this has been revoked, obviously, but you think at the beginning this was a bad idea?
Absolutely. I don't know exactly how anyone thinks that it couldn't be a terrible idea. I mean, and in every sense that you want to think about it, it goes against our own principles, or at least what I assume are our principles. It weakens, you know, our claim to possessing superior values, specifically where we claim to say that we give our women choice over how they want to conduct themselves, how they want to behave, versus non-Western cultures who may be a little bit more coercive in how they expect their women to behave. It weakens our claims to being superior in that way. And from a practical perspective, it really just is bad policy. It hurts us. It hurts the most vulnerable of Muslim women. And it helps the case of, you know, Muslim clerics who will, I can bet, use this as a rallying cry to say that, you know, the women aren't any more free in the West, but just enslaved in a different way. And our way is moral. Our way is the religious way, the way of God.
Sarah, when did you leave Islam?
I left Islam when I was pretty young. I was a teenager. And part of me leaving Islam, and this is something I address a little bit in my article, was that I was never obligated to behave differently. I was a Muslim girl growing up, and I adopted Muslim values and ways of dress and behaviors, and I accepted the narrative that the religious people around me had given to me, which was that modesty was my armor, it was my protection, it was good for me, it was the moral thing to do. And when I did leave religion, it was out of my own free will. It was just by being convinced that these values that I grew up with weren't really as moral as I thought they were. And I think that's the point, that we need to be convincing Muslims and Muslim women to behave differently and to give them an option and not to coerce them into being one way or another.
In your article, you allude to, or I think actually you say outright, that had you still been a practicing Muslim or Islamist, and you had seen the burkini ban or a ban on some sort of a dress in this way, that you would have seen it as a reinforcer of the covering of women in some way, right? I mean, this would just draw a larger circle around quote-unquote Western values and the need to stand against it. Did I misinterpret that, or is that accurate?
It's two separate things. One being that I would have seen it as people in the West are just, they're just wanting you to trade one set of chains for another. So if I had been thinking that, you know, the Muslim the way that I had grown up may be a little bit constraining, I would no longer see the Western alternative as being less constraining. So it would weaken the allure of behaving in a little bit more Western way from that perspective. But also, and I don't know if this would have necessarily been the case for me, I don't think so, but I know that the most vulnerable Muslim women, if they are not allowed to cover when they go out in a public place, such as the beach or the pool, what it will mean for them practically is that they won't be allowed to go out at all. They will be forced to stay home just a little bit more and just be a little bit more isolated and a little bit more secluded. And all that does is make them more vulnerable to extremist ideology because they're not wandering around in the world around them. They're not making friendships and, you know, interacting with other people outside of the little, you know, Muslim bubble. And the bubble is what's dangerous. So we want people to interact with the world around them. We want Muslims to interact with the world around them. And we want them to feel as if they're a part of a society and not very different and very much an other.
Is there any instance of a woman covering herself up in the name of Islam that isn't in some way oppressive, diminishing her worth in some way, or how do you see it?
Well, in my opinion, the ideology that underpins the concept of the hijab altogether, which is to say that a woman's body, most schools of thought will look at a woman's body from, you know, the neck down to your feet and just your feet and your hands and some say your face, is not private parts. Everything else, it's almost as if they are, you know, an extension of what we would consider genitals, which is to say that it's all something that must be hidden. And I think that's a very toxic way of thinking about the female body. And that's a very toxic way of thinking about female sexuality and women's sexuality in general. So I think that even if an individual woman, let's just say she happens to grow up in a very liberal household, or maybe she wasn't even raised Muslim at all, and, you know, she encounters this and she feels as if this empowers her, and she chooses to put it on. No one is forcing it on her. She's not being socially coerced to wear it. There can be a case where she does it out of her own free will. Having said that, that's rare. It's rare that it's not, you know, the woman puts it on completely outside of this whole, you know, socially coercive bubble. But it's possible that she does it. But even still, it's still something that unfortunately adds to the ideology that a woman's worth is bound to how much of her body she exposes.
Well, this is where it gets sticky, because then on the surface, you know, if you're just going with the momentum, you're going with the tide, you say, well, of course it should be banned, right? It oppresses women. We should get rid of it outright. On the surface, this is the argument being made.
Yes, and I understand where it's coming from, but the hijab is just a symptom of the ideology. So that's what we need to counter. We need to counter the idea that a woman's worth is equal to, you know, how modest she is, how pure she is. That's what we need to talk about. This is just a symptom. So if you're forbidding people from wearing certain things without acknowledging that the ideology that underpins it is in itself terrible, then we are in a really bad place. We're in a place where Muslims will feel that they are being coerced for no reason. I think this is actually where we are at the moment, because I think we've talked about this before, Seth, where it's very difficult for people to criticize the ideology of Islam. It's very difficult to get away with it without being called, you know, Islamophobe or racist or a bigot. And I get called these things regularly. So I'm trying to counter the root of the problem, and I get smeared for it. And yet people are thinking that if we ignore the root and attack the symptoms, the branches of it, then we're actually doing something, but we're not. And if anything, we're arming them.
Yeah, we're in the arena of ideas here, right? Who was it who said, and it's been said many times, that the cure for bad speech is more speech, you know, to address the ideology behind the actions. Thanks for the work that you're doing with ex-Muslims of North America. I'm going to include the link to the text of the article on Heat Street where they can read all of your thoughts here. And I'll put that link in the description box of this show. And thanks for everything you do. And thanks for talking to us here on the radio. Been great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, I'm going to talk to author Chris Matheson. He is the author of the book, The Story of God. He's got some stuff he wants to give away to some of our listeners, and I'm going to get a chance to read some additional pages that he has just added to the paperback, releasing very soon. And we'll talk to Chris and do that here in just a second. Hang on. Chris Matheson is an American film director and a screenwriter, arguably best known for a couple of films which arrived in 1989 and 1991, respectively, the Bill and Ted series, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. He was co-screenwriter for those films. He's done some other work as well. And he wrote and released last year a book called The Story of God, a biblical comedy about love and hate, and he joined me last year on the radio, and I read a portion, just a few paragraphs from his book, and it was awesome. And you can find that in archive. The broadcast is called The Story of God, and I will link it in the description box of this show in case you don't want to go browse for it on Blog Talk Radio or YouTube. But Chris Matheson has some new stuff going on in relation to The Story of God book, some new material and potential free stuff for our people. And so I wanted to have Chris back for a couple minutes to talk about that. Chris Matheson, great to have you. How's it going?
Good, Seth. Good to talk to you.
You know, when I introduce you and I mention that you were co-writer for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, there sort of becomes this parting of the Red Sea. There are those who nod and smile and say, oh, man, yeah, I've seen it a dozen times. And then there's a demographic that's like, who's Bill? Who's Ted? And quite often you find out they were born in 1998.
Yeah, I think that's true.
However, it still exists out there. It's still in the ether. It's still part of some pop culture conversations. I mean, it's one of those films that's sort of a defining piece of that decade, I think.
Yeah, you know, there's like a whole new boxed set of both of the movies and all kinds of background material coming out just in a few weeks. And Keanu actually is participating in this one and speaking about the movies, I think, maybe for the first time. So there is an ongoing level of interest for these movies, which is good. It's gratifying.
It's interesting that he would participate, and good for him. You know, sometimes when they hit the stratosphere fame-wise, they distance themselves from other material, or I'm just too busy or important. But the fact that, you know, 30 years later, he'd be participating in that way, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think for a long time, he sort of wanted to maybe break away from the character of Ted. He thought he was linked a little too closely with the character of Ted, that people thought he was Ted. But I think now he's enough time has passed that he feels sort of a real deep affection for the character and the movies, which is good. I'm glad.
So when you released your book, The Story of God, first of all, synopsize what you've done for those who are joining us late. Maybe they didn't hear the earlier conversation. If you're pitching this to a new listener, how would you do it?
I basically took the Bible from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, and I rewrote it. I trimmed it back, of course, dramatically, but I rewrote it as a comedy from the point of view of God. What does he think he's doing? Because a lot of his behavior is so strange and volatile and kind of incomprehensible at times and so destructive and mean. And I tried to get inside the character. Like, what does he think he's doing from beginning to end? What is his emotional state? Who is this guy? And that's the story of God.
It's like the life and times of an omnipotent sadist dumbass is kind of how you've, I mean, you're reading it. And of course you're not making this up. You have linked your interpretation of this or your translation of this to specific scriptures. You're really using the Bible to build all this stuff on.
Yeah, very much so. There's a lot of crazy stuff in there. And I'm using chapter and verse throughout because I wanted it to be very clear, like, you know, this is the Bible. I mean, I'm extrapolating particularly with regard to his inner life, but in terms of the stuff that he does and the insane things that happen, I'm really using the Bible from beginning to
Chris,
end.
Chris, how much hate and death and hellfire and pain and damnation and condemnation have you gotten? I mean, is the Liberty University crowd, you know, has the religious homeschool crowd discovered you and decided they're going to flood you with protests? Has that happened at all or no?
You know, Seth, it really has not up to this point. And I all I can assume is, I don't know really what to think. I think it's maybe just like, if you're a believer, why would you read this book? Although I actually ended up feeling I have a kind of a weird sympathy for the character by the end. You know, I don't hate this character at all. I think he's kind of sad and sort of tragic, really. But no, I really have gotten very little so far. And I'm glad for that because I was sort of dreading it. I was sort of dreading, you know, those kinds of messages. But then again, I'm not really easy to access because I'm not even really on I'm not on social media at all. So they'd kind of have a hard time, you know, threatening me, I suppose. And also, you know, I wrote a movie called Rapturepalooza that came out a few years ago with Anna Kendrick and Ken Jeong and Craig Robinson. And I already sort of did some of this stuff because at the end of Rapturepalooza, you know, it's about the rapture. It's a comedy about what happens, you know, when the rapture actually occurs. And Jesus flies out of the sky and gets laser beamed and killed. So, you know, I figured if I could get that one across that, you know, that I could probably do this too.
When we last spoke, you were, I think, in production or planning the audiobook on Audible, and it is now available. Is that right?
It is, okay. Sir. And I got 10 of them to give away to people who want them.
You've been generous enough. Another reason I wanted to have you on the radio is because you are giving away 10 Audible.com copies of The Story of God, read by the author. You did this yourself?
I did, yes.
So if someone wants The Story of God in Audible.com format, the audio book, I'll just say the first 10 people, and we'll take them in order, who email podcast@thethinkingatheist.com, and you put The Story of God Contest in the subject line. The Story of God Contest, the first 10, we will select. I will forward their information to you, and you will hook them up with a free audio book. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you've added to the paperback version, which is releasing or has released. You're right on the heels of it, right?
I am. It's in the next few weeks the paperback comes out.
With the paperback version, you supplemented? You've added some stuff that wasn't in the original printing?
I did. I added an epilogue, which I called Satan's Story, which is a condensed version of the same story, very condensed. It's about 20 pages, but it's Satan's point of view on everything that's just happened, specifically Satan's point of view about God.
With your permission, I'm going to read a few of those paragraphs. Certainly, I'm not going to read all 20 pages. I'm not even going to read two, but I'll read a few paragraphs to sort of let the listeners in on what we're talking about. That'd be cool with you?
I would love that.
All right. Well, Chris Matheson, The Story of God, first 10 people, podcast@thethinkingatheist.com is the email address. Thanks for doing that. That's kind of a cool gesture. And all my best and all success with the paperback and the audio and whatever on The Story of God, okay?
Thanks, Seth.
Okay, let's read just a little bit of this for the audience. Give them a sample of what we're talking about. The Story of God, Postscript, Satan's Story, Part 2. I still don't understand why the old man created woman. Why not create a reality where there were only males, which he so obviously preferred? I'm not totally sure, but my belief is that God had a powerful feminine side that needed to be expressed. He was terribly uncomfortable with it, scared of being homosexual, I suppose, though why that scared him, I still don't know. But the way the old man treated Eve was unkind. The poor creature had just been yanked into existence, fully formed, an adult, given no time to grow up, and was now facing her creator, who seemed to dislike her. How can I help her? I instantly wondered. The old man had placed a tree he called the Tree of Knowledge of Good and Evil. He was pretentious that way. In the middle of the garden the humans lived in, he told the man, Adam, that if he ate of this tree, he'd instantly die. I was pretty sure that was bullshit. That the point of this tree wasn't knowledge. The point was obedience. And I told the woman so. The old man's reaction to the humans eating the fruit was fascinating. He turned white with rage and literally stomped down from heaven and around the garden, yelling at the humans, "Where are you?" He loved to claim that he knew everything, but stuff like this kinda gave him away. The man and the woman, poor things, were resting in each other's arms when the old man found them. He stood there, hands on his hips, a hard, cold gleam in his eye. But underneath his anger, I saw something else. A tiny little smile. The old man was happy.
about the way this had gone. He liked being mad at the humans, I suddenly understood. He wanted to blame and punish them. "You will work," he shouted at Adam. And I wanted to point out, he's already been working. It's a meaningless threat. But I didn't. "You will suffer giving birth," he snarled at the woman. Another meaningless threat, I wanted to say. "You were already going to have a hard time giving birth, Eve, for purely physiological reasons." But before I could speak, the old man turned on me. It was the first time he'd ever looked directly at me, and it was strange. He looked imperious, utterly superior, but there was also a palpable undercurrent of insecurity in his eyes. "As for you, serpent," he said, "you will crawl on the ground." I almost laughed. "Serpents already crawl on the ground," I thought to myself. The old man followed that up with, "I will also make sure that women hate snakes," which was laughable too, because I was possessing a snake. I wasn't actually a snake. Why was he threatening all snakes? It would have made sense for him to say something like, "Henceforth, all humans will despise you, Satan." But to issue empty threats to snake kind? Weak. As Adam and Eve exited the garden, the old man looked at me again and spoke, this time in a lower, quieter voice, less for effect. "Now that he's become like one of us," he said, nodding to Adam, "what if he should eat from the tree of life and live forever?" I stared back at him and thought to myself, "What the hell are you even talking about, old man? There is no tree of life. Why would there be? What would it be for?" But here's the thing with the old man. Once he said something, he would never, and I mean never, back down. He'd keep digging his feet in deeper and deeper to prove his original point. In order to prove that there really was a tree of life to protect, the old man now created what appeared to be flying manservants. They were muscular guys with wings, dressed in short white robes, all of them quite handsome and athletic. The old man gave them swords and told them to chop off Adam's head if he tried to sneak back into the garden. And that is just a little taste of the additional pages added to the story of God, Chris Matheson, from the perspective of Satan. Again, all those links will be in the description box of this show. Thank you so much for listening this week. I will see you in California in just a few days. Again, details on that tour, thethinkingatheist.com/events. Our next broadcast is about interfaith relationships, or even the relationship or marriage or life partnership between a believer and a non-believer, you know, someone of no faith. Are you one of those people? You might be interested in this broadcast. Does it work? How do you make it work? What's it all about? We're going to talk about interfaith relationships next week, and I will see you next time on the Thinking Atheist radio broadcast. Take care.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.